Hi, and welcome to the weekly Morningstar Men's Podcast. This one was recorded on the 12th of December. It's the second of a two-part series on effective communication. Today we're going to look at just a basic pathway or plot line for how to deliver a good presentation. There's going to be a little bit of review. We're going to cover a few things about the basics of assembling an idea and how to transfer an idea from the presenter to those who are the recipients, those in the audience or those reading along with something that's been written. And following that, we're going to just do a quick overview of the important components that any speaker needs to keep in mind if they're going to deliver a powerful, memorable, and effective communication, an effective oral presentation. The end game of all of this, we need to keep in mind, is that it doesn't matter how much we talk, it doesn't matter what we say, it doesn't matter how much we entertain. We who are in the business of communicating for life change, we can't consider anything that we've done to be effective if people don't first remember it and then do something positive with what they've heard. So listen along, take some notes, and I hope this will help you for those times and places when you have to do some communication, maybe in the business world, maybe in your home even, perhaps in a church setting or maybe as part of a nonprofit board. I hope this will be a blessing to you. See you again next week, guys. Oh, this will be a little disorganized this morning. I just want to tell you that almost every rule, and we're going to talk a little bit about how to organize and deliver a presentation, what points not to forget. In the course of the next hour, I'm going to break every one of those rules at least once. So just want to be out there with that. Okay, a little bit of review, not just for the sake of review. I can see Jim holding the paper at arm's length, which means, John, you're not the only one who needs glasses.
Yeah, but he's got his glasses with him.
Yeah, what's up with that?
I didn't know if there was a riddle.
No, there's no pattern. I'll explain it all. It'll make sense in a moment. Patience. All right, so we said a few defining factors, things that will pre-qualify you. What did we say about the message? Anybody remember? It was the first thing that we talked about. That before you get up, before you sit down, in other words, before you get up to speak, before you sit down to write, you need to understand one of two things that qualifies the message that you're going to deliver.
It must be new or a new way to present it.
That's it. You either have a new idea or you have a new way to present an existing idea. We said that every generation needs champions and advocates for the timeless principles. But also in every new generation, there are new technologies, there are new ideas, and they need advocates to speak for them. So either a new way to present something that's old, or a powerful new idea. Otherwise, if you lack one of those, we said you're just contributing to the noise. The next thing that we did is we pre-qualified the messenger, and we said there's one of four different reasons that would compel or motivate a person to speak out, to speak up, or to write. Anybody remember what they were?
I got something to say.
Okay, we said the first one was you believe that you are a representative of the idea, that the idea is going to die apart from your championing it, speaking out on behalf of it. What's another one? You believe that you got a call, that you do have a call. That either God Himself has called you to advocate on behalf of something, or in the absence of that, maybe you've been given that call by someone else. The third one is a regular responsibility. We said somebody like John or like Jim, they have responsibilities. They have to speak every week. So it doesn't matter if they don't feel like saying something, they have to have something to say. But let's keep in mind that that doesn't eliminate the need for them to say something important or necessary, because no one wants to be noise. And then the final, but what we said was probably the most dangerous reason was what? Anybody? Huh? Yes, because they just simply have this overwhelming desire to speak, to get up in front of people. Oh, I'd love to do that. That would be such a great job. If you don't have anything to say, you're going to be sorry you got up there sooner or later. I don't know why he's laughing right now, but there must have been something.
If you have something to say, you're sorry you got up there.
Okay.
So it means when you blow it, you know, it's not like afterward, after you speak, and you said you deliver a lesson, you don't critique yourself and say, man, well, I blew that. I could have done this. I should have said this. Man, you know what? You know what I mean? That's hard to do. You know what I mean? And to let someone do that for you, hey, how was it? Well, you know, because I usually will talk to people and say, what did that look like? You know what I mean? My wife used to be my biggest, because she could say it to me without crushing me. You know what I mean? She'd say, well, you know what? This probably could have been better here.
At which point, because Jim introduced that way, we can be reminded of the quote that I shared with you last week from the founder of LinkedIn. And he said that if you can't look back on some of your early attempts with a degree of embarrassment, then probably you waited too long. So have you ever been, if you've done this for a while, embarrassed by something you've done in the past? And I can look back on things that I've done in the past, and if you think I have long study outlines now, you should see what I used to use. And I realize there is no way that anybody got anything out of this. Which brings us to the first point of the morning. How do you and I take a complex idea? And that's what an idea is, because we think an idea is a single thing. But it's a single thing in our mind because we have gradually assembled it and created a whole. And that's what, incidentally, all these little squiggles on the front page look like.
I thought it was a secret code.
No, it is not a code.
I thought it was some sort of weird Star Trek thing. I didn't read it.
And so if you look at the box... if you look at the box in the top left, inside the box, we're going to call that a house. Right? It's a primitive house. But the house is representative of your idea. And your idea is in context to the black dot outside. Context always delivers a reference point. Do you remember one of the reasons that we said, or one of the things that we said a person can offer to someone is relationship between your idea and what they already understand? We called that perspective. So you're offering them a new perspective, a new way to look at something. That's what that black dot represents. Now, all this is already inside your head. Don't minimize the number of hours or weeks or months that it took for this idea to fully formulate in your mind. Because when we do that, when we assume that this was easily developed in our own mind, what's our next assumption as speakers? It'll be clear to other people. If it's easy, if it's in my mind and I get it and it seems like it's one simple idea, surely when I go to speak it, other people are going to get it. Have you ever been met by blank stares?
I stared.
And you were sure it was simple, it was easily understood. But let's consider this little house, right? Five components. And let's say that your idea is based on five solid subcomponents that represent the idea as a whole. What is the overall process that it is going to take? Because the diagram all the way at bottom right, that's what we want to happen. That's in somebody else's mind. We want the top left to become the bottom right in somebody else's mind. Does that make sense? We want them to see and to feel exactly what we see and feel so that they can go out into the world and do something with that, which is the next important thing. What do you expect someone to do with what you've delivered to them? If you have no goal in mind for what you hope them to do with the important things that you are communicating with them, then you've stopped short. You've just been a great storyteller. And even a storyteller has a goal. What's their goal? To entertain, to amuse, to delight, to make people laugh, whatever it is. Even the storyteller has a goal. So this is important even for something as simple as a testimony. Your personal story is not just your personal story that you need to tell to get it off your chest. Your personal story, if you stand up in front of someone else and share it, is a connection that you are attempting to form with another human being to help them understand something about themselves, something about God, something about redemption that they didn't understand before and they can then act on. So again, before you sit down to write or stand up to talk, understand clearly what you hope to happen. Now, it may not, but you need to have that as a goal. So let's look at, and I love something that John said last week, and we're going to come back to that. He said, it's better if people leave your talk questioning a few things and thinking about a few things. Have you ever heard someone talk too long? Besides me.
I've talked too long.
And it was really good, and people were getting something out of it. But then you crossed a threshold. And you started to shut down the enlightenment that you had created. And one of the things that it took me a long time to understand, and just because I understand it doesn't mean I practice it, is that it would be better to stop a little bit short so that people are thinking about what you said when they walk out the door. They still have a few questions. Because you know what a question does? It nags you. It makes you want to return to the idea and think about it more and more and more. But if you answer all their questions and you answer the questions they didn't even have, then they have no interest in thinking about it anymore. All right, so I want to introduce something that's going to help us. The words are not on your notes this week. They were actually in your notes from last week. A great presenter understands something about their audience. So when you speak to someone, when you share things with them, it has to be close enough to them so that they can make a connection. And then it has to be accessible to them because they have to understand it. So let's look at it like this. So suppose you don't know something, and all you're lacking is a body of information that would help you to be able to live life more successfully. And let's say that you live next door to the public library. That makes that information adjacent to you. But now let's say that every time you go to the library, it's locked. You never get in. So the library isn't accessible to you. So our goal is to get things close enough to people. Remember the carbon atom from last week that we said? That what we are trying to do is find some connection to some node of understanding that already exists in the person's mind, and we want to link this new idea to something that's already inside of them.
Well, when Paul said, I know that unknowable God, I know him.
And so in that, he connects something that they're curious about, one of many gods, and he says, there's a specific God, yes.
I know him personally. You know what?
So let me tell you a little story that can help us to appreciate both adjacent and accessible. So for a number of years, if a baby was born premature, and we'll push this back 200 years, if a baby was born prematurely, it was almost a sure thing that they were going to die. That the vast majority of infants born prematurely, that was their fate. And then over a period of time, doctors started to develop some theories about what might help premature babies to live. The result of that, yes?
I can speak directly to that long ago. My wife was a premature baby born in the 50s. They used to put you in an incubator with oxygen immediately after you were born. And just so happens where she was born, down in Abington, there was a new young doctor there who had gone through training and was, had all of this information was accessible to him. And he happened to be adjacent to where she was. He immediately ran and said, hey, don't do that. You're going to make her blind. Because what used to happen to premature, very premature children, they were blind or almost blind. And if you've ever seen Barbara, you know she wears very good glasses. You know, and I don't know if that helps at all, but somewhere in the medical book, there's Barbara is written about because this new thing that they found out that you had to do with premature children, or you would create a blind person. I don't know if that helps us.
Well, I'm assuming they didn't eliminate incubators altogether.
There's a place for it, but they don't introduce oxygen to the to.
Okay.
It's a place where it's warm, but there's a new piece.
And that's the issue. That's the issue. It's warmth. It's not necessarily the oxygen, it's the warmth. Because if a child has a little bit more body mass, they can retain body temperature, and body needs to be at a certain temperature. Well, anyway, back to the story. The incubator was the solution to that. Well, so in first world countries, where science is at its pinnacle, and where medicine is at its pinnacle, incubators are accessible. And so the idea is both adjacent and is accessible. But the problem is that in third world countries, that's not the case. Most hospitals don't even have the money to buy an incubator. And so we in the first world, the developed world, in our wisdom, we decided, well, the surest way to solve the problem is we're just going to ship incubators over there, and then they'll be both adjacent and accessible. If you've ever read stories about third world country hospitals, you'll know that reporters go in there and they're shocked to find first world technology sitting off in the corner collecting dust. And invariably the question comes up, well, why aren't you using this? It's right here. And it's usually one of several things. A, nobody knows how to use it. B, the power doesn't function sufficiently. Or C, and this is the big one that we're going to talk about, for the lack of one part that breaks down, the thing is now dysfunctional. In other words, it's a great idea, but nobody has the money to buy the spare part. Incidentally, that happens a lot with drinking water systems that are provided for third world countries, which is why one of the goals of most NGOs that are developing drinking water solutions today is make it so simple, so easy, that the locals can find some sort of part and fix it and get it back up. Well, anyway, back to the incubator. So now, the idea is there. But how do we take the idea and make it real for us? Remember, we want to link this to the reality that the people that we're speaking to live in. And so someone starts to put the pieces together. Well, what's really going on? What makes the incubator, which we understand, what makes it really work? And it's the heat. And so some enterprising young fellow says, do you know what? I'll bet you if we took car headlamps and we put them at the right distance away, and we just built this little box, we could probably make something that would work. And the really great thing about car headlamps is we could go to the junkyard and get some. And so that's what people started to do. And so, in many underdeveloped areas of the world, an incubator is nothing but a little box with some Toyota headlights that are plugged into it, hooked to a 12-volt battery that can be recharged by somebody else's car. And so they can take the entire electrical component, lift it out by the handle, put it back in somebody else's used Toyota, and charge it up, and it's ready for the next baby. And so they take a first-world idea and they transfer it into something that is usable for them. And that is our goal. How do we help people with the understanding that we have that may not be perfectly suited to them exactly the way it is, but how do we help them to understand the main principles to it, link it to their understanding, so they can actually put it to use? Because the amazing thing is, and this is what someone like John really wants to do, what if his audience leaves at the end of Sunday morning and they have a head full of knowledge, but they don't quite know how to connect it to where they are and do something with it? All right, we're on to page two. Unless, is this...
I mean, it, kind of one of the things that we have to do, I believe, as a church and as those of us that do speak, is make sure that we let others know, hey, if you have any questions, you know, John, when John prays up front at the end and people raise their hands and he says, hey, fill this out and bring it to somebody. And
keep talking while I... Oh, you're going to do that? Thanks.
Let somebody help you. You know what I mean? Like, let somebody help you do those initial steps, those baby steps, so that you can get to a point where at least you can move independently. You can sort of, you can manipulate the idea on your own. You can search it out on your own. And that is it. And the electronic treehouse is full of all kinds of information and misinformation.
So it really can be very confusing for us because they're going to go, look. And then you have the other guy who's saying, no, it's like this. So now we really, those of us who do try to talk, deliver an idea, really need to kind of be on our game because they're going to change. With what I do for a living, that takes more than for a living. And boy, let me tell you, when they come in, they know it all. They've already looked. They have lots of friends who told them how they work. And you have to take the information, show them where it is in the book. Look, this is what it says. This is what it means. This is where that part is. Not everybody can fix it. They'd like to think they can. They can.
Which is why I suspect WebMD has been the frustration of many a doctor, right?
I think, you know what? And this is an absolute sin. You can go to a psychiatrist's office, and my mom has a sponsee who's done this. You know what? I don't really feel like this is working. I think I should be on this. He writes the script and lets her walk out.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, we're going to move back to what I hope are some productive thoughts. So, essential things. I need to have something worth sharing, but I need to have a way to understand the people that I'm going to target, the people that I'm going to address. So it is both the idea and it is the people, and I need to be able to refashion the idea so that it fits the people. So what I'd like us to do is turn over and we're going to take a walk through the introductions to four stories about Jesus. We call them the Gospels. All right, so let's go to Luke 1. Now, if you were to, as an outsider, and let's say someone who was not a Bible scholar, if you were to assume that four people wrote four stories about the life and times of Jesus Christ, you'd assume that they essentially had the same objective, the same audience, the same purpose, and therefore they'd be pretty similar, right? But nothing could be further from the truth. While there's a lot of the stories that are the same, the approach is very distinct for each one. Where did I tell you to turn? Okay, we'll start there then. Luke. Okay, so let's look at the way Luke introduces himself and introduces the story. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all of these things closely for some time, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things which you have been taught. Okay, so that's his introduction. It's a little wordy. If I were writing it, I might put a couple of additional punctuation points in there, but that's neither here nor there. And then, immediately, what's his next thing? In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. How are we to understand Luke's account? What is Luke telling us? I'm going to deliver a historical account to you. And to demonstrate this, I am immediately tying it to both time and people. In the days, that's time, of King Herod, that's time. If you doubt this, you can go out on your own, independently. You can fact check this. Was there a King Herod? When was he born?
So people were still, I know him. I was still there. Maybe they were old enough to even know who he was or to have been the, whatever, or the timeline, the grandchild or, I know I'm a relative of that guy.
But Luke does something else here that's very interesting. He addresses his critics before they have a chance to complain. In other words, for the person in the audience who says, well, what makes you think that your story is accurate? How do you know this? Where'd you get your information? He, in advance, assumes the objections that are going to be in the minds of future readers, perhaps on the lips of those who he might share this with, and he says, let me tell you how I arrived at all this information. And then he goes on to say, I interviewed people. He says, I borrowed from their accounts. I took the best accounts. The accounts that were delivered by the eyewitnesses who were actually there seeing the stuff from the people who were actually doing the stuff. So Luke is what we will say is a third-hand individual. So first we have the people who were doing, Then we have the people who are watching. And each of the people who were watching started to tell a story about what was happening. And Luke goes out, exactly like a good reporter, and starts interviewing all of those people. And he looks for overlap. He looks for similarity. He looks for credibility. And when he finds what he's looking for, he writes it all down. And what's his purpose? An orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things that you have been taught. So the guy has already received a body of knowledge. Have you ever known something but been unsure if it was true? And so what Luke wants to do is bolster Theophilus' confidence in the fact that everything that he's already learned has credibility and it's staked and rooted in time and place. Now that's one way to begin a presentation. Now why does Luke do this? Is Luke's information going to appeal to everybody? Probably not, because some people are not historians by nature. They're looking for something different. Jim.
And in a court, too, back then in the court, they weren't either allowed, even today, it's just today. Did you see it happen? No, but I know the guys who saw it happen. You know what I mean? Like, you can only go out so far, and then the judge is like, get out of here. You're not credible. You're not a credible witness. He used only credible witnesses. And even back then, they knew that. Wait, you saw that? You know the guys? Yeah, I talked to them. He said he watched it happen.
Now let's turn over to Matthew. Remember, same story, or at least the same focal individual that's going to be the hero of the story. Yet Matthew begins it from an entirely different perspective. I don't know what your heading says. Mine heading says the genealogy of Jesus Christ. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abram. Don't worry, we're not going to read all this. How does he begin this? Does he begin it in a way that a typical person on the street in let's say some city in Turkey is going to care about it? No. He begins it with a very specific audience in mind. The closest that you're going to find to something like this, if you turn back to the book of Chronicles, and you'll see the book of 1 Chronicles begins with genealogy that traces people's history. Who's that important to? A Jewish audience. And so he begins with this because this makes his document feel authoritative to a Jewish audience. They're familiar with this. They're familiar with stories that begin with a genealogy, and so he begins with a genealogy because it's the language that they understand. But then he moves into the next thing. Now the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Now here's the interesting thing. If you were, we'll say, a Greek person, we'll just divide people into these two classes of people. We'll say Gentiles and Jews for right now. Okay, if you were a Gentile, you probably didn't believe that much in miracles. You didn't maybe take stock in miracles. Now, the Old Testament is filled with stories of barren women who later became pregnant. The only key difference is that they didn't become pregnant from outside forces and sources. They became pregnant because their husband. Right? So there was a miracle at work, but the miracle was at work within semi-natural forms. Matthew takes this one step further and he says, but this was a miraculous birth on two accounts. And then he moves into the story from there, and immediately he goes down and he validates this in a way that only a Jew cares about. He ties it right into their Old Testament prophets. And he says, behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a child, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. Does the person in Turkey, does the person somewhere in Asia, do they care about that? No, but the Jewish person would take this very seriously. So here's a man who has decided who he's going to speak with. His audience isn't going to be everybody. But to the people who want to hear the message this way, it's extremely important. Let's turn over to Mark. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before you, who will prepare your way. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight." And then he says, "And John appeared, baptizing in the wilderness and proclaiming a baptism of repentance." A lot of people think that this was probably the first of the Gospels written. You can actually look at some of these opening lines and say there's credibility for that. Why? Because 100 or 200 years later, most people weren't going to know who John was. But within a relatively recent time frame, after these things occurred, people would still... the name John would have meant something to people. Mark, setting down what we presume to be the thoughts of Peter, is addressing a Jewish crowd. Again, he appeals to prophecy. But he thinks, where will I begin this? And Mark is kind of a no-nonsense, or Peter will say, is kind of a no-nonsense guy. And he says, well, let's just begin with the story that leads up to and introduces Jesus. Now, we have three different people, just three, talking about the same story, and look at how different each one of them is in the way they introduce it. Let's turn over to John. John, it's presumed, is probably the last of the Gospels to be written. So here is a guy who is older. So when John's writing, he's thinking to himself, how do I record something for people who I won't be able to see face to face? I'll never be able to answer the questions that they have. How do I help them to understand something that's going to be extremely confusing to them? How do I make sure, to the best of my ability, that this message is clear in their minds when there's no one there to explain it? Think about this for a moment. Allow yourself to go back to that time and suppose that you were tasked with writing a narrative that was going to be transmitted from generation to generation and was going to explain the life and times of Jesus and why it mattered for people to know that. Where would you begin that story? And how would you tell that story, knowing full well that most of the things that you were going to write about were going to be fodder for skeptics to criticize for years to come? Because after all, who would believe this story? Who in their right mind would believe this story? So how do you tell what you know to be true in a way that people are going to at least give it a credible consideration before they dismiss it? Jim?
I think that's why it's so imperative that we tell only what we know to be true. You know what I mean? Not sort of like bringing in outside ideas, only what I know to be true. When they said Jesus spoke with authority, because he knew, he wasn't guessing, he knew. When this guy really, he really seems to be, you can't push him off of this thing, man. No, he can't, because he knows. And so for me, I can only teach what I know. I can't teach over here or over here. You know, most of what I teach is a lot of my life experience. I can't quote chapter and verse and lots of stuff like that. But I'll tell you what, I've lived. Let me tell you what's changed me the most.
Okay, let's look at the beginning of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Okay, so in the opening sentence, what John does, if you dissect this a little bit, is he brings together the Gentile and the Jewish mindset. In the beginning was the all-powerful force that created the world and holds the world together, the Logos, or the Word. In the beginning was that force. And then he says, and that force was where? Don't look at me. Where? The book. That force was with God. But then he takes it one step further. Okay, do you see where he begins? Why do you suppose he begins there? Remember, oldest of the book, greatest distance. He's going to die soon, perhaps. He presumes that. He doesn't know that.
He's establishing that from the get-go. this is?
Because the only way that anybody is ever going to take stock in any of this, if there is some link between Jesus the human and God the divine author of everything we see. How else could you explain miracles apart from that? And so he takes people right back to this and he says, if you're willing to at least give this a credible hearing, for those of you who believe in a force that created things and holds it together, I'm with you. For those of you who believe in a divine God, I'm with you. It just so happens that the two are one and the same. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through Him. And without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it. So this guy that I'm about to tell you about, do you know why he can do what he said he can do? Do you know why he was able to do what I'm going to tell you he did do? Because he was in fact God. Because who else could do that? Right now John has set himself up. At least he's gotten their attention. But what's his challenge from this moment on? How do I convince people that this guy really was God? That's the claim that I've put out there. Now they're going to have to make up their mind based on the stories that I tell them about this. Now turn over to John 20. Now you've seen this verse hundreds of times maybe. I'm not telling you something you don't know. We're going to look at the last verse of John chapter 20. It would appear that this was the closing of the book, and then he decides to add some things on. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. Remember what we said? Before you begin, have an understanding of what you hope to accomplish and what you hope your listeners to do with what they hear. This is John's game plan. This is John's mission statement for why he wrote the book. So everything that is contained between what we just read a moment ago and what we read right here, everything that is sandwiched between those two is an attempt to convince his readers that they can have a credible belief in what he's going to tell them. So here's what we can conclude from this. Four different people, four unique ways of communicating the same idea. So we can say, there it is. Is it the same idea? Essentially, yes. It's a powerful idea. But it's a unique way of expressing it. Do you feel that we in the 21st century would be missing something if we didn't have one of these Gospels? Yeah, probably. It's beneficial for us to have all four of them. So just because someone has said something before doesn't negate your privilege or opportunity to say it. Just make sure you express it in a way that is different and appeals to a particular audience. Which is why before you ever sit down to write or get up to speak, you need to know specifically something about who you're talking to and what their cares are, what their worries are, what their doubts are, what their fears are. All right, now we're on to, finally, page 2, which is the backside of your page 1. Isn't that good news? Take a moment to tell your audience something about yourself. Who are you? What qualifies you to speak anything? And more than that, tell them why you're telling them this. So for me, one of the things that I have shared with you from time to time is that a lot of what we've studied in the past, we studied because I was curious about it. I wanted to know more about it. And as I started to bore down into something and learn more about it, I became excited about it. And then I wanted to share it with you. Many times it was evident that you weren't quite as excited at the end of it as I was, but that's okay. I thought that I could take you as a guide and walk you along through something that I was discovering. There's other times when I felt like I actually could be authoritative about something and would share something with you from a position of really having a confidence that I knew something. Same person, two different motives. One time, I'm a discoverer. I'm one step ahead of you. Let's discover these things together. I think I at least have a way to help us discover together. Another time, I'm pretty confident that I know this stuff. Let me share with you everything that I know. So you may get up on two different occasions and be a completely different person in terms of your relationship with the material that you're presenting. Does that make sense? You're so quiet. I don't know if I've lost you 10 minutes ago or you just... Who wants a nap?
Well, one of the things that I notice, speaking, I get to travel around and share, is the type of audience in society is changing. You can't preach in a way that doesn't include some form of, I've tried this, it works, I encourage them to try it. If you speak only as if a sharing a dissertation on something, the audience is just gone. They don't care. It's about building a relationship where you had the audacity to believe that the Bible is real and tried it and it actually worked. Okay, well then maybe I can try it. Over and over again, when I get to travel around and share on Sunday mornings, the recurring thing is, after the sermon, I never would have had the courage to try that. I'm going to try it and I'll let you know what happens. All right, cool, well that's what the Bible says. To believe in absolute truth of the Bible, presenting it in a way that is attractive to people means I've done this. And so I can't present it to people in a way that's not relative to them. You can't just get up and speak about something. Like they don't, the churches where I've been don't want an expert on something. They want somebody who's trying it and is functioning out of it. I believe that's why so many people love Pastor John as a speaker. I'm still hearing on the streets from people, I can't believe Pastor John said, I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ and I struggle with anger. I can't tell you the number of people that I've heard that have said in tears that it's now okay for them to acknowledge their identity is in faith in Christ, not in the struggles, but not in the victories. I think that's amazing. The difference between Christianity, real Christianity, is that John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You have denominations out there that add that little A, the Jehovah's Witnesses, that He was a God. We can all become like Jesus. Well, yeah, we believe that too, but not the way the Bible means it, not the way their biblical interpretation is, but to have an understanding of how can it be relative to the people that we're talking to. Try and be Jesus sometimes. That doesn't work too well. That's why we need bracelets and we need shirts that say, what would Jesus do? We need those things to kick us out of our sinful nature to make us think about how would Jesus really respond to that. Now, pulling out of Chick-fil-A Thursday, right there is a guy with a cardboard sign down in the city. Right there is a guy with a cardboard sign that says, Vietnam vet, still hungry. And so I have the guy who's replacing me at work is with me, and I'm eating my fries, and we're driving around, and there's this guy. He's not asking for money, he's asking for food. And so I hand this guy, I said, would you give him ask him if he'd like my fries. And he's like, but you're eating. Yeah, well, if he's hungry, he'll want fries. And he's like, yeah, okay. So he rolls down the window. Now this guy's like 6'3" and 250 pounds, so he's not a little guy. He says, would you like some fries? And I says, yeah, can I have them? And he hands out there and rolls up the window, the light turns green, and we go. He's like, I can't believe that worked. Simple things where the application is based on the truth. I couldn't get rid of the sandwich. That was already in the back seat.
At what point, Vinny, did you hear, give him your food?
Yeah, as soon as I saw the sign.
Right. As soon as you saw that sign, you said, I cannot drive past this. And not at least make an attempt. Not at least make an attempt. That's hard. You know, because for so many, oh man, what am I going to say? Do you want some food? Don't try to make this profound statement. Are you hungry? Do you want some meat? Here, Jesus said, go give them something to eat. Mm-hmm. They're not going to listen. They're hungry. Give them something to eat. You just got his attention. Maybe there was a bumper sticker on the back of your car. Maybe you were wearing a CR hat. Maybe there was a Bible sitting there. And he's like, man, I can't believe it. Ah, there's his Bible. He must have been Christian. He must have been something. He must have been a vet. He must have been, you know what I mean? And the funny thing is, you didn't even have anything to say. Do you want surprise? That's it. It wasn't hard. Well, it could be scary.
See you, Jim.
But it goes back to the introduction doesn't work if we try to share from your point of, like we discerned last week, the difference between an expert and a teacher, something like that.
Most times it doesn't. In certain times, people do want an expert. Some people do come to hear an expert. Some people do come to hear. In the audiences that you're speaking to, experts are doubted. Because experts usually spout out information that you later on find out is either not reliable or they don't live according to the information that they say is so important.
And I think they add credibility, though, when they share, I haven't always been an expert at this.
Yeah.
I had a journey. I came to a place. There's
TED Topics.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody who speaks for TED Topics begins with, I didn't understand this and I didn't know what it meant. Here's what I've tried, and here's how it worked. Some of the best speakers they have are people who have failed over and over and over again.
Really?
And it wasn't that they found the right answer. They found lots of wrong answers, and in the meantime, they found cures to different types of cancer, ways to cure blindness, all these different things.
That's Thomas Edison. That's all.
They could really present and cast the vision of what they were doing. That broke people into the interest.
Okay. Anybody else? And remember, we're making this applicable to each of us. This is not just theory that you're not going to go out and use. It's how do I take this and repackage it for me where I am? It's funny, I was just thinking when he shared the Chick-fil-A story. So when I get around, I see a lot of people with cardboard signs, unfortunately. The problem is, I'm pretty much a cashless person. I don't know how you are, but I can go for days and not have 50 cents in my pocket. Okay, well, I'm not going to give the guy with the cardboard sign my credit card and say, prosper and be well. I mean, that's not going to work. And so, you know, what do you do? Well, I would avert eye contact, obviously, because I don't have anything to give him. And it would nag me. And then I'd have to stuff the nag down and just ignore it for a while. I don't know where it was or when it was, but some months ago, I decided, you know what? I can't be that person who's going to put the $2 in their hand or give them the whatever right now. But is there a solution that I could implement that would help people who find themselves in that situation? And so what I decided some months ago was, for me, the solution is, I'm just going to take a set small amount every month and I'm going to give it to, in my case, for years I've periodically given to the Allentown Rescue Mission. And so I decided, okay, every month I'm going to give some small amount to them that would at least be the equivalent of what I would give to people that would be on the street. And hopefully, at least if I give it that way, there's going to be some vetting process that the money that I give is actually going to be used for something useful and it's not just going to buy the next quart of liquor that they need. Now, that may not be the ideal solution for the guy who's standing there with the cardboard sign. But it helps me to address a problem and say, what would Jesus do? Well, if Jesus didn't have any cash, even Jesus, unless he pulled it out of a fish's mouth, wouldn't be able to give it to him. Right? Even Jesus wouldn't. And so Jesus, just like me, would have to find an alternate way to do it. So for me, that's my solution. Vinny's is to share his lunch with somebody, even though he did eat part of it before he shared it.
And they were good, too. Yeah, they were like right out of the fryer.
Yeah, we get it. We get it.
I love the chicken strips.
We definitely get it.
I can smell it.
If you can give away those fries, they get automatically in there. Jesus, like, here's the Chick-fil-A crown.
Is that the way you picture heaven? Jesus is going to be waiting at the gate for you?
with Chick-fil-A?
Yeah. All right. So, we're going to get down to what started this whole 2 weeks now, which I shared with you some time ago, I guess, was that about a year ago, I was driving down the road and I was thinking, well, what would I do? What could I share with people? It would help to maybe create a few people who could function as leaders, as teachers, as speakers, either here or somewhere else. How could I multiply my impact a little bit more? And so I started to take some notes down on what were the main things that I felt were really helpful if you were going to deliver a talk. So here's the first one. And like everything else that I do, it started out in my phone while I'm driving down the road. It was 7 points. It was crisp. It was clear. It was understandable. All right. And then I got home and I sat down and I thought I could elaborate a little bit. And so now, 15 points later, it's a little bit more detailed than it was. So forgive me, that's just who I am. Let's just move into it. You as the speaker are not the main event. Your message is the main event. Your idea is the main event. Make sure you are not a distraction to the message. Now there's a lot of ways that people can be a distraction to the message. Some people just wear strange clothes. Right? Don't do that. Some people are just so uncomfortable, ill at ease before other people, that everybody else is kind of a little tense or on edge the whole time. I don't know how you are. This is my hang-up. I get embarrassed for people who ought to be embarrassed. Like, if they don't know that they need to be embarrassed when they're up on stage, I get embarrassed for them because I feel you should be embarrassed. I can't hear anything that they're saying because I'm feeling so... Don't look at me and judge me, okay? Because I just... No, don't do that, please.
There's people that sing.
Uh-oh, he has a story.
And they think they can sing. And it always amazes me that after all these years that they realize they can't sing, but they think they can sing. That's why I love Simon Cowell. American Idol. You know, the person tried out and says, well, who told you could sing? My friends, he goes, you need new friends. You know? But and then you hear that and you're so uncomfortable and it really...
So the first thing you need to do is put your audience at ease by you being at ease and comfortable and not a distraction to everything that you're going to say. All right, next one. Focus the attention on the topic. Tell them what you're going to say. Introduce them to the topic. Don't just launch into what you're going to say. Tell them why you're going to say it, what you hope them to get from it. Acclimate your people to what you're going to say. Remember what we said last week. The first thing that you have to do is interrupt their attention. They're already thinking about something. Excuse me. So the first thing you have to do is interrupt their attention and tell them why what you're going to tell them from that moment on will matter to them and how they should understand it. So how do you begin this? And for me, there's a couple of different ways to begin. Did you see the difference in the ways the four gospel writers began? My word, they couldn't have been more dissimilar in the way they began. But each one had a way to capture your attention. So one of the great ways is begin with a question. Just ask a question, a really sticky question. Maybe it's the question that got you digging into the topic to begin with. And you ask the question in a way that kind of nags people and haunts them. And then your entire presentation from that point out is to build out the answer to that question. Or the reverse of it is, answer the question. Make a bold statement. Remember how John began? In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning was this all-powerful force that created the universe, held the universe together, and in the beginning was God. Well, if you're not a believer in God, that's a bold statement. And it forces John now, from that point on, to construct his talk or his written work in a way that convinces people, yes, there is a God. Not only is there a God, but there's a God who became human. John is obligated from that moment on to deliver on the promise that he made by making the bold statement. Alright, so we've already talked about the distraction thing. You are only going to have a few moments. If your first few moments don't connect with people, I would say pretty much all hope is lost. That's just my honest assessment of it. Make it count in the beginning, or people are going to be looking at their watch and wondering when they can get out of there. And it's the same in a book. Why do you read chapter 2 in a book?
Chapter 1 got your attention.
Yeah, and apart from that, chapter 2, you're never going to get to chapter 2. What if the best information was in chapter 2? What if everything that would change your life was in chapter 2?
Chapter 1 has to hint at it at least.
Right, there has to be the promise of something great to come. And it has to be delivered in a way that will make you want to pursue it further. Don't assume. So I'm kind of disciplined as a reader. I'm kind of disciplined as a listener. And so there's a lot of times where I'll force myself to get to chapter 2 and 3 because I tell myself this story. Surely something better has to come in chapter 2. Or surely something better has to come in the next 5 minutes than in the last 5 minutes. Why else would they be up there? But not everybody is that disciplined. Have you ever been nervous? For those of you who have had to speak in front of somebody else, have you ever been nervous?
Sure.
You know the best way to get that out of the way is just to acknowledge that kind of stuff? That you are a little uncomfortable, that this isn't something you do all the time, that you are a little unsure about the topic or yourself, or here's another one. And John, you'll appreciate this. For people who are apologists and go into college auditoriums and they give presentations to skeptical people, and they have the audacity to come into a materialistically minded audience and tell them that there is something supernatural out there. Well, they're walking right into the lion's den. The audience is there to find fault with the speaker. Think of the courage that it takes, knowing that your audience is not only not neutral, they're against you from the moment you open your mouth. How do you deal with that?
So you make sure you're not adversarial in your presentation when you start to break down that wall, try to soften that.
I want to see a good example of that. Go to YouTube and watch Rabbi Zacharias speaking in the Mormon temple. He was invited to speak in Utah. And boy, that isn't an eye-opener. And he is just exactly what you said. He's not adversarial. He just lays it out there. And speaking in front of those elders or whatever they call them, the saints or whatever they call them, he really, really does. That's a perfect example of how you want to do that.
I can see that.
Yeah, that's great.
What's that called?
Rabbi Zacharias.
I would say probably about
maybe 4 or 5 years ago, if not more, but it's out on YouTube, and he's speaking in this gigantic church or gathering, whatever they call it. Really, really good.
Is there a title for his talk?
I forget what it is. You can find it.
You can see that just with Mormons, Tabernacle, and so on.
Yeah.
He's a great apologist.
Yeah.
Okay. Point number 5 and point number 6 are somewhat connected, so I'm going to try to tie them together. Make sure that you have a clear and connected message, but make sure it's not predictable. Here's what I mean by that. Your mind, and we all know this, but your mind runs faster than my mouth. That's hard to believe, but it's true. So that means that if I'm not occasionally saying something unexpected, where does your mind go? If you can already finish every sentence that I'm going to say, if you already know the conclusion to every point that I'm trying to make, what do you do?
I'm just going to beat you to the end and then think about whatever I want.
Yes, you are, aren't you? Because why would you bother to invest the intellectual energy to continue to listen to something when you already know what I'm going to say next? And so while you're, remember what we said before already, 90% review, 10% new. But you need to say the review in surprising ways. Are you the kind of person who typically tends to package up word phrases that are used commonly and just use them again? Don't do that. Force yourself to express an idea in a new way, even if it's the exact same idea. Why do we always say salt and then pepper? So if you want to use that illustration, maybe say pepper and salt. It at least breaks the monotony of something. John?
I heard a perfect example of that. I heard a guy, instead of saying represent Christ, he said represent Christ. And that was just, and it caught my attention right away. I was locked in from that moment. All he did was change the way he pronounced the word. It was exactly what you're saying. You're representing something. If you hear represent Christ, if you hear it too many times, it's just like, you know, you're already thinking about 10 other things, and just flows right through. It's like that information just kind of, but he stopped me in the way he said it, representing Christ to someone. And it's just like, no, that, I didn't hear that before.
And in keeping with that, one of the most interesting ways to help people think through things is to actually break down the words that they're so familiar with but yet never stop to think about. What does this word really mean? I use it every day, but what does it actually mean?
That's exactly what it did.
Yeah. Okay, and here's the next point. And this is one that I learned over the years and I think it's a valuable illustration. You can't fill in all the gaps, right? Have you ever watched one of those half-hour television sitcoms? We all have, right? And they jump from somebody's house out onto the street and to the bar and back and forth and they go here and there. Do they tell you, do they show you the scene with the guy walking to the bar? Or no, they don't. What assumptions do they make?
You're going to fill stuff in.
You are smart enough to be able to fill in the gaps. The question is, how big do the gaps need to be? Because that's what keeps your mind busy in the interim between one idea and the next. You're filling in the gaps, and the gaps need to be logical. In your presentation, you're going to, if you go back to page number one with the silly illustration of the house, each one of those points in your presentation is one of those lines. You need to put enough space, just enough space between the lines so that they can logically make the next step and the next step and the next step. When your presentation points are too far away, just imagine walking across a stream on a collection of stones. Have you ever done that when you were 10, 12, 15, 35? Good. What's your goal when you walk across those stones to the stream?
Get the other side out.
Yeah, without getting wet. Okay, well here's what happens. When we're delivering a presentation, people don't get wet, they get lost. And from the moment they get lost, they can't find their way back. And they have no idea how point five, when they finally catch up with you, has anything to do with point one because you lost them for two, three, and four. And so your presentation, here's a different way to look at it. Have you ever walked up a flight of stairs? We all have. Have you ever walked up a flight of stairs that wasn't spaced the same as you're accustomed to? Have you ever tripped on the way up or down a set of stairs or found yourself making these unusual, awkward, like you had to think about walking on stairs? Who has to think?
The escalator is broken.
That is exactly the way our mind works. Make sure that the steps are logical and predictable so that people know where you're going, but yet pleasantly surprising along the way. Review the points every so often. Because remember what we're trying to do. We're trying to build a house at the other side of their understanding. We're not just trying to deliver a bunch of points that become a bunch of lumber. You want them to build a house in their mind, not have a stack of 2x4s, and if you don't help them to connect the points, all they have at the other end is a stack of lumber and maybe a box full of nails. From my time being in the audience, at even great presentations, I arrived at number 8. Allow some brief points for people to catch up and jot something down. I've been in some really rapid-fire presentations, sitting in the audience already, listening to people, and I just wanted to push a pause button so I could write something down, so I could get the... And they're already on to point four, and I'm still trying to write point two down before it all slips from mind. Have you ever found yourself in that situation? So even... do you see what I just did right now? 5-second pause. That 5-second pause gives somebody time to process the thought and if they need to, write a note down. And so here's one of the differences that I believe is true between confident speakers and those who aren't. Confident speakers are comfortable with quiet. Do you hear that? That's quiet. And yet a nervous person needs to fill every space with something because they're not sure that quiet is okay. Quiet is the time when the audience processes what you just said in the last moment. And if they never have time to process, remember the carbon thing that was up here? I need multiple whiteboards so I can refer back to the previous ones. Maybe we can invest in one of them. They never make the connection, and the idea is lost. We need to give them enough time to find something in their mental framework to hang the idea on before we move on. And if we don't, it's out the door and it's gone. And they'll never use it. And remember, we started out with this simple statement. Have an objective in mind. Don't just have a talk. Have an action point that you want people to take. Because that will inspire you to slow things down a little bit, make things clearer, give some pause points, so that at the end, they actually have something usable. It's not about you being interesting and entertaining. I mean, hopefully you are. It's about them doing something with what you've said. Okay, number 9 is pretty straightforward. Information is like feeding someone. Right? But they have to have, it's a different way of saying what I've already said. They have to have time to chew it. They have to have time to process it. They have to have time to digest it and think about it. All right. Season your presentation with interesting stories. Now, we all get that. We've all heard that. Let me tell you something about stories. This is the one thing that I have to say about stories and jokes and all that. Have you ever heard a story told and pretty soon the story was bigger than the point it was trying to illustrate? In a moment, we're going to talk about memorizing things because I'm a fan of memorizing. That's one of the reasons why I said I'm violating my own principles here. Because I don't have all this memorized right now, and I'll explain that. Tell good stories. Selective stories. Use some illustrations, but here's the other thing. Make sure the story fits. Make sure it's concise. Make sure you know it so that you're not stumbling over the facts and the details. But my word, make sure it's not a story that everybody's heard 20 times. Okay? I'm just going to say this once. All right, here it is. If I offend somebody, it surely isn't the first time I've offended somebody, and it won't be the last. If I hear the starfish on the beach story one more time, I'm liable to explode. We've all heard the starfish on the beach, and it made a difference to that one story to the point that we don't need to hear it again. Find a new way to illustrate it. Remember, you want to keep your audience's attention.
What's funny about that? Uh-oh. Last time I heard somebody use that, I was thinking that, and it amazed me out of that audience how many people just love that story. I never heard that story. And it wasn't that long ago. I'm sitting here thinking, I can't believe that. And then it overwhelmed me. Like, I heard all these people like, are you kidding me? Yeah.
These are people who live on Earth, right?
Yes.
Okay. I take that back. I'm sorry.
No, I agree with you, but yet, like, you gotta be kidding me. Yeah.
A lot of people haven't heard that story. They haven't, really.
Okay, enough about the starfish. That's now become a distraction to the talk.
I forget that. Can you tell that?
I'm sure it'll be dumb.
One of the things that will help you well is to search for useful quotes. Keep some supplemental materials there. They're supplemental. They're not the main point. But stay in touch with a good newspaper, maybe a couple of books. You want to draw in some ideas from other places. Okay, as you start to wrap things up, I've talked about this before, but tie it together. Make a bundle to go out of the whole thing. You want to do one final recap where you tell people in concise bullet point, these are the things we've talked about. This is why it matters. This is how you can use it. And this is how you can take it into your daily life. Sometimes Vinny is my tie it together in a bundle person because he'll stop at the end and he'll tell a story that kind of like pulls it all together. He's probably working on such a story right now. I'm going to avoid eye contact in case he's not. That way, he's off the hook. Bring the call to action. This is something that John is excellent at. You'll hear him at the end of something, do something with what you've heard. Do you need to come up and get some prayer? Do you need to make a statement? Do you need to make a personal, internal profession or commitment to do something? Will you, the speaker, have an obligation almost to call them to do something? You know what? People are amazingly lazy and sedentary in certain ways, and they won't do something unless you remind them of the fact that they should. Make the ask. Okay, two final points. Don't talk beneath your audience. I'm amazed at the number of times that I feel like I am sharing tired, boring information that people have heard before, and I try to say, I know you've already heard this before, but let's just remind ourselves of this again. And then I find out later that there was three or four people who had never heard the whole story before. And so somehow find a way to tell the things that you need to make sure that everybody understands without insulting the people that have already heard it or read it 20 times. Do you know what I'm saying? And that's the challenge. When John talks on a Sunday morning, think about this. There's people that have been Christ followers for 30, 40 years. There's people who aren't yet Christ followers and haven't read three chapters in this book that are in the same audience. And somehow he's got to tie them all together and help them all to get something out of a presentation.
Now you're really making me nervous.
Well, John, if we go back up to this point, you can acknowledge your nervousness in the next time you talk.
And that's the challenge. As I said last week, here we are at Christmas. There's a lot we all are going to see.
And yet, when you do man on the street interviews and you look at what young people understand about Christmas, actually maybe we haven't all heard about Christmas.
Like I heard, this is off the wall. Never mind, I won't get into that. I'll tell you what, I was heard on the radio. Talk show on the radio and guys on the street, like Waters World does.
Yeah.
So he's asking them, mostly women, but people. So you like Hillary Clinton's proposal that she's going to institute Sharia law if she gets elected president. I think that is a great idea. First, you have to know Sharia law. But person after person, I think that's good. That's good. I believe in Hillary. That's good. There you go.
Scared.
Yeah.
All right.
Let me give you one example. They came up to somebody. They were doing this earlier this year. The guy came up to people with a Hershey candy bar and a bar of soda. A bar of soda. Little ingot. And they said, what would you rather have for 50 cents? The majority of the people took the candy. That bar of soda was worth about, I don't know, $18,
$19,
$20. Took the candy.
Really?
Oh, idiots. Yeah, I'm sorry. Like you said, people are just, man, they're out there. A bar, really? Really?
So if we think about that, represent Jesus Christ, or represent, they don't really know who he is.
Yeah.
So we have a fantastic, unbelievable story to share with them that's true. And I heard years ago from a speaker, and this always challenges me, God forbid we make this war.
Say that again, John.
God forbid we make this war the Bible, the story of Jesus boring, and we've all been guilty.
Yeah.
You know, I think you'll get challenged every time. This is boring stuff.
Or that we try to fit everybody. I watched a Muslim converting people in New York City. This is on YouTube. And so he leads this guy in a prayer in Arabic first. Doesn't tell him what he's saying. He says, all right, you got to pray this prayer in Arabic to be a Muslim. The guy says, okay, great. And he says it in Arabic, and then he says it in English to repeat it. And he says that, you know, he goes through the five pillars of faith in Islam. No God but Allah, worthy of being worshipped. Muhammad was his prophet and his messenger. And then he says, and Jesus was his prophet and his Messiah as well. His messenger and his prophet as well.
Not Messiah.
Man. And then when you look through the reviews, there were the Muslims who know what the Quran says who were calling him out, like, what are you doing? That's not what we believe. That's not what we confess. You don't read people in that word. And then there are Muslims who say, Allah Akbar. And are agreeing with this guy who's going against their own doctrine. And it was just amazing. We've got to know what we believe and what is actually biblical and what are the things that we're saying that are just out there.
It always amazes me that the democratic process works, huh? Everybody gets a vote. Think about how little most people know about what they're voting about. Anyway.
I know, that's what I was thinking when I was driving yesterday listening to that on the radio. I was like, maybe we should rethink this.
All right. Final point. And I said to you before that I believe in memorizing things. And at this point, I owe y'all an apology, honestly, for some of the past weeks. If you notice, the outlines for everything through the Every Father series were, we'll call them somewhat long. I think that's a charitable way of saying it. It took a long time to write all the stuff. And in the process of getting all the ideas down, what I didn't have time to do was commit them to building blocks that I could systematically deliver. In other words, I didn't have it memorized. And so there were times when you may not have appreciated that much, but I was extremely frustrated with myself throughout that entire series because I had to keep looking at notes all the time to see where I was going next because there was so much stuff. So if you have the luxury of doing this, the best thing to do is take time to formulate the script and then start to commit the building blocks to memory. There's a great story that probably some of you have heard, but I think really sums this up. At some point during his years of protest, Mahatma Gandhi was invited to address the British Parliament. And they're expecting this frail man to walk up there and perhaps talk for an hour or so, and that would be the end of it. Well, he walked up to the platform without so much as a single page of notes, and everybody thought, well, this is going to be quick. He spoke for the entirety of the day, unscripted, and yet everybody said it was a profound talk, it was clear, it was understandable. How does a man speak for 4 or 5 or 6 hours without a single note? Because the ideas are all inside of there, and he knows them, and he believes them, and they're logical and sensible to him. This is the final step in making a great presentation. Break it down into individual components. Understand the principle and give yourself a cue. And look at this diagram at the bottom. This, to me, is helpful. Every idea represents a box or a room in here. And all the ideas tied together. Your job is not to memorize everything you're going to say about the idea. My word, if you believe in the idea, you already know what to say about it. Your job is to make sure that you get clearly from point one to point two without dropping the ball or letting your audience slip off the stones and get wet. And so your job is to create a cue. I'm leaving room one, I'm entering room two. And a few phrases at the end of your point, of point one, remind you that they lead you to point two, which is the next room in your presentation. And in that way, you create rooms and doorways, and you move from idea to idea to idea based on your own verbal cues. And that way, you can engage with the audience instead of doing what sometimes, unfortunately, I do, which is engaging with my notes. And no one wants to look at someone who's shuffling through notes. They want to look at someone who they're confident, believes what they're talking about, and wants to help somebody else with it. All right, I think we're done. Questions? Incidentally, you should all find a better way to end than I do, because I think that is my favorite way to say we're done, is I think we're done. That is not an inspiring way to end.